Opinions expressed in this program are for general information purposes only and are not intended to provide specific advice or recommendations for any individual or any specific security. It is only intended to provide education about the financial industry. To determine which investments may be appropriate for you, consult your financial advisor prior to investing. Any past performance discussed during this program is no guarantee of future results. Any indices referenced for comparison are unmanaged and cannot be invested into directly. As always, please remember investing involves risk and possible loss of principal capital. Please seek advice from a licensed professional. Bulwark Capital Management is an investment advisor representative of Clear Creek Financial Management, a registered investment advisor.
Welcome to Know Your Risk Radio with Zach Abraham on AM 770 KTTH. Whether it's preservation of capital or an aggressive growth strategy, every investor needs a clearly defined risk profile. Know Your Risk Radio is brought to you by Bulwark Capital Management, helping families navigate the ever-changing and often treacherous financial markets. Know Your Risk Radio starts now. Here's your host, Zach Abraham.
Another week, another show. Thank you guys so much for joining us. As always, got a great show planned today. And should certainly make it, once again, the most scintillating show in finance radio. Again, small market segment. But hey, we're sticking with it. So anyway, a lot going on, and we've said this the last, probably months, last 5-6 months. The news just keeps rolling in, and I don't think, we're going into summer, and summer is always going to be, less volatile, less crazy than the rest of the year. And believe it or not, a big reason for that is just vacations. People in Wall Street are, out on, where do they go out to the coast? What are they? The Hamptons. That's where they go. See, I should know that. If I was one of those East Coast moneyed blue bloods, I would know these things. But, it's funny to go, especially on Wall Street. Go down to Wall Street during the summertime and it's a ghost town. Even though the markets are open, everybody's out of there because it's so stinking humid. Anyway, but got a great show planned for you today. I have a special guest. We've got Peter Bookvar with us, and we're going to follow the same format that we have in the past because we had the good luck of getting Peter on, and Peter's a prolific writer. You can follow him at P Bookvar, B-O-O-C-K-V-A-R on Twitter, P Bookvar. You can also go to the Book Report, B-O-O-C-K, bookreport.com, and he puts out I believe it's daily. I'm a subscriber to it. I follow it. A great economic thinker. He's a chief investment officer at Bleakley Advisors, and he's a CNBC contributor. So if the name sounds familiar to you, you've probably seen him multiple times on the TV. He's on CNBC quite frequently. And just a really sharp thinker, contrarian thinker, the kind of guys that we want to talk to. He and I have a decidedly different take on the whole tariff scenario, and I think he made some really good points. So anyway, we're going to start that interview, and about half of it is going to run during the hour of the show. And as we've done before, if you want to hear the remainder of the interview, which I would strongly encourage, you can just go to our podcast website. You can get our podcast. You can go to our Apple iTunes page, and you can access that through bulwarkcapitalmanagement.com. Or you can just Google Know Your Risk Radio Stitcher. You can pull it up any different ways. Just Google Know Your Risk Radio. Google, go to My Northwest. They've got the podcast. There's plenty of places to find it. And then just subscribe, and then you can get weekly updates, and they just come to you. So again, we're going to cut the interview off short, and we'll give a warning at the end of it as well to remind you. But you're going to have to go to the podcast page to get the remainder of that interview. So anyway, let's get into the market update. I think the biggest thing that we're looking at this week is gold. Gold really continues this impressive move. And for those of you that want to know why we're paying attention to that is, look, if we look at the last 10 years, and there's some guys that would try to disagree with this, but I think the vast majority of bright minds and practitioners in the world of finance would agree that the number one single biggest driver to economies worldwide over the last decade, really without any close second, has been central banks. And central banks have been able to do that essentially because of the credibility that they'd built up and the faith that they'd built up in their currencies. And The only real constraint a central bank has on the creation of money, which is, you know, let's make no bones about it, that's what's happened over the last decade. In an effort to stimulate global growth and to stimulate economic growth, central banks have printed $22 trillion worth of fiat currency and pumped it into the markets, essentially. And they can continue to do that. That game can continue to get played as long as there's credibility in a currency. And one of the biggest ways, the biggest way to look at whether a currency is believed, whether it's credible, whether the market has a lot of faith in it, historically has been that currency's valuation in relationship to gold. And that's one of the things that's caught so many people off guard over the past 10 years is gold has gotten smoked. In this period of time where central banks are, you know, exercising largesse to a magnitude that the world has never seen, to a magnitude that we didn't think was possible. Now, we're all used to it now, but you know, do not suffer. Don't be a victim of that cognitive dissonance and just write it off as the new normal. Oh, central banks are pumping. Oh, big deal, right? Because there is a price to pay, like everything. You know, there is no free lunch. And gold has always been that harbinger or the indication of that harbinger of reality setting in, meaning that, you know, this is nothing new. Go back to Roman times. We've got coin clipping going on back there. We've got several different circumstances. England getting in the 1600s, taking out a ton of debt to finance a war and not paying it back and defaulting on it to Spain. You know, you got all these circumstances of central banks, you know, going outside of the normal operations and really relying or leaning against the credibility of their currency. And like I said, the way the ruler that we're always, you know, using to measure how much credibility is left and how valuable, if there's any value at all in a currency, is by measuring it against gold. And like I said, gold has just been in one of the nastiest, biggest, longest bear markets that we've seen at any point in the last 50 years. And that the roof on gold for 5 years, almost six, I believe, has been 1350. It hit there and it would just drop. Just go up there and test 1350 and drop. Well, we broke through 1350 last week and then broke through 1400 to the upside. And got as high as 1430. We've pulled back about 15 or 16 bucks since then. But it's showing remarkable resilience. It's not showing that impetus or that desire to plunge. Now, look, you got to reassess these things constantly. I mean, it's still, you know, there's obviously the potential it could crack. But it's just interesting to us when this is happening, right? This is happening when global growth is clearly slowing, right? The Fed is getting ready to cut again, which I think is baked into markets. I think it's one of the safest bets you could possibly make is that they're going to cut at least 25 basis points. Some guys are forecasting as much as 50 basis points. I think it's going to be 25. I think that the Fed feels comfortable about the ammo they've got in the chamber. I think they want to go easy. I don't think they want to come out of the gates with 50. I think they think that if the 25 doesn't have the desired effect on the market, and listen, this is speculation, okay? So I want to throw that caveat in here. But just listening to them, the feeling I get is that, A, they're hesitant to cut at all because it's a reversal of path. And just 6 months ago, despite what guys like me were saying, they thought they were going to keep hiking and just normalize, which, look, that's not going to happen. It's not going to happen this year. It's not going to happen 5 years from now. You cannot build up this dearth, this level of debt that is financed at record low rates and think that you're going to normalize rates without creating catastrophic consequences. Okay. It's just not. And if you need proof, as we've said many times on the show before, just go look at Japan. We're very different than Japan. I know there's a lot of things, but they're boxed in, at least for now. And there's just not going to be this easy normalization process. It's not in the cards. So I think that they've got a 25 basis point cut tied in. Now, remember, the dollar typically goes up in value during recessions. So I think that's, and gold is denominated in dollars, right? That's how we price gold. What's gold trading at? 1413. 1413 what? Dollars, right? Like all other commodities, it's denominated in U.S. dollars. So if we're moving into a recessionary environment, and look, gold has rallied in recessions before, but I just think it's curious that gold finally breaks out from that range it's been locked in for the last five, almost 6 years. And it does it right on the cut, right in the midst of this slowing growth, Fed about ready to cut rates again. And I think this rate cut is a really big deal. Again, we cannot suffer from cognitive dissonance. I remember, this kind of reminds me, Darren, have you caught this on Twitter? It's that whole, I'm old enough to remember when. Have you caught people miming that? It always cracks me up. But I'm old enough to remember when you had to sell gold because interest rates were going up. And the only reason why gold was high was because you couldn't make any interest owning bonds. So that made gold attractive, right? Because you weren't missing out on those dividend payments. That was the big argument. And this is the beginning of the hiking cycle. Look, you know, it's interest rates are going to normalize from here. This is sans, you know, this is circa 2011, 2012. Party's over for gold. And the faulty belief at that point was that gold cannot rise alongside interest rates. Now, we did research on this, and we look back in history, and there's absolutely zero evidence saying that that's the case. As a matter of fact, the highest gold prices in history, especially on an inflation-adjusted basis, occurred back in the, I believe it was 1980 on the dot. Interest rates were significantly higher than they are now, and they were going up. They were moving up. So I've always thought that was a nonsense argument. At the same time, when the market believes something, you got to roll with it. Well, I kind of see this as potentially the beginning of the erosion of the sandcastle that central banks have built over the last 10 years. Because now, I mean, we should all see that the emperor has no clothes. The whole idea that we're going to rally economically out of this and we're going to normalize and this is just a short-term ditch, that should be gone. Every rational human being out there should realize that that's not the case. This isn't going to be a normal process, right? And the Fed cutting rates in July, if they do, I'm a firm believer that they will. I think it's already priced into markets, as a matter of fact. I think they have to. And the reason I think they have to is because that is what has predicated this run-up in stocks, at least in the last 2 to 3 months. And if they don't cut, if they don't match market expectations, they're going to get a fit. They're going to get another tantrum on their hands. And I think the market either, you know, and you risk further instability and further shocks to the downside. I just see there being no reason, no justification for not cutting. And like I said, that to me is the beginning of the erosion of the sandcastle that central banks have built over the last 10 years. That's the official, you know, confession that, yes, we're not going to normalize. We're a decade into this mess and we still can't normalize. We tried to normalize last year and a 1.25 or 125 basis point increase in cost on 30-year mortgages sent new home sales spiraling downward by 19% in a single year. And it's a narrative shift. And remember, we got to be conscious of narrative shifts because when we're living in a world where we can literally print trillions of dollars out of thin air, narrative is really all we've got, right? It's the story. You got to have faith in the currency. You got to have faith that the Fed's doing the right thing. Step back and look at it and go, wait a second, I didn't used to have faith. I used to invest in real things. And now, as investors, we've got to adjust to the idea that the single biggest factor on the value of our underlying investments is what central banks do. Now, do companies play a role? Yes, there's other factors, but I'm saying the single biggest factor is what is the central bank's role and what they're currently doing and their interest rate policy and all that kind of stuff. So, you know, I very much think that that rate cut is baked into the cake, as they say, and there's no way out. The other interesting thing about this, and again, now we've been talking to you guys for the last really 2-3 months talking about how global growth is slowing. And one of the real oddities of this market run-up so far this year in 2019 has been economic indications moving the other way. The United States is still strong, especially on a relative basis, but it's not this locomotive that everybody's playing it out to be. And I think the biggest part of that is the weakness abroad. So I don't think it's anything domestically here in the U.S. But if we really anticipate, if this really is a soft patch, you would see bond yields, you know, going up, anticipating more inflation. Now, as we sit here today, we've got the U.S. 10-year bonds back below 2%. It's had a massive move down. Actually, one of our most profitable trades over the last 6-7 months has been long U.S. government treasuries. I think we're up 16% or something like that on that single trade alone. So that, you know, that's been great. But when you've got yields plummeting like that, and you've got stocks going the other direction, one of them has to be wrong. One of them has to be wrong. Now, I think it's really interesting, the story that stocks are telling, because now so far this year, we got two straight quarters of declining earnings year over year. Many are thinking we're about ready to have another a third. So we're officially in the midst of an earnings recession. And yet asset prices don't seem to care. So, like I said, one of these things has to be wrong. And one side or the other is going to be completely off sides. And there's going to be some fireworks. But it'll be interesting to see how this really, you know, filters out. The other thing outside of gold and rates, markets were somewhat tame this week. Not a lot really went on. Not a lot of big swings. I will say this. Some of those stocks that we've been talking to you guys about in the recent past, some of those ones we've been kind of issuing those alerts about those blow-off tops and getting obscenely overpriced, they've run into some weakness all of a sudden. And it's really just in the last week and a half, 2 weeks at the most. Some of those crazy IPOs that we've spoken so much about have gotten smacked down. I mean, they're still way overpriced. I mean, like, you can't make any sense out of it, overpriced. But not quite as obscene. The other thing we're starting to see is a little bit of a perk up in value. Now, maybe I'm being optimistic. You guys know I'm a value investor. But hopefully this is kind of a trend change, and it seems to be. So we'll have to keep a close eye on that and keep an eye on those developments. But, I don't want markets to go down. You know, I'm not a glutton for pain. I manage money for a living. It's much easier to make money for clients in a rising market than it is a falling market. I will say this, though. I am excited by what I'm seeing with gold and bond prices because I do want some fear back into this market. I want some sense of reality because for guys like us who are much more rational, you know, much more value-based investors, much more nose to the grindstone, much more, you know, traditional, I guess you'd say, you know, reality being injected back into markets is our friend. You know, for the last 6 years, it hasn't mattered much. It's go out there and find the thing that's got the wildest growth story or growth expectations. And you don't need any results. You don't even need profit. We don't care if they're funded by debt. We don't care what it is. Just show me growth, baby. And that's just a really tough environment for guys like us to operate in. So I'm hoping that this is a return to some sanity. I really do. Either way, though, something's got to give. For these indexes to move substantially higher, you're going to have to get participation from more of these quote-unquote value-type stocks. The divergence has just gotten too wide. The other thing is that, you know, you're going to have to see some of these, the leaders, regain their momentum. Like I said, a lot of those stocks that led the charge over the last 7-8 years, you know, they're still significantly off their highs that were set last September. It just feels like to me that we're getting to a capitulation point, not necessarily the market's going to plummet, but that we're going to at least see some sector rotation, that we're at least going to see some of these high flyers, you know, sober up a little bit at least and watch some of that capital flow into some of those, you know, types of stocks that we're after on the value side. You know, companies, now this sounds crazy. This is an antiquated idea, but companies that actually make a profit. Yeah. Those are the ones we're talking about. And anyway, outside of that, guys, there's not a whole lot going on. The one thing that that I did want to talk about, though, is the idea of diversification. So we've we're moving on from the market update. We're going without the typical breaks in between because we're trying to condense as much as we can into the front part of the show because we got the interview coming in the second half. But diversification. And what I like to call the new diversification, and this was brought on by a client meeting that I had this week, or a potential client meeting I had. Great guy, sat down for about an hour, had a talk, has a substantial portfolio in the $2 million neighborhood. And he is in an algorithmically managed ETF portfolio. So very similar to a portfolio that we use, one of our portfolio options for our clients. And we've spoken about it on the show before. You can certainly contact us to get more information. But the whole idea is this. A, by a computer-managed model, we eliminate human behavior out of it. And we and the real advantage to that is we have what we call a non-predictive model, meaning you've got an investment model that is changing allocations based on stone-cold facts. Okay, now, they might not always be immediately beneficial, but these computer algorithms are very good at exposing client portfolios to more risk, more stock during good times. And they've been very good at lowering exposure to stock in bad times. And the one that we use, our model is called Helios. And the one that we use is not predictive. It's reacting to real data on the streets. And it's responding to two different kinds of data. So it's looking at market internals, looking at the structure of the market. Is the market healthy? Are there enough stocks moving to the upside? All that kind of nerdy technical stuff. It's that's what it's following. And then it's reading economic indicators. And, you know, they say you can't predict a recession. That is true. But you can tell with a very high level of certainty, if in an unbiased fashion you're looking at the data, you can tell at a very high level certainty when we've entered a recession or when we're teetering on the edge. When you consider the fact that we are in the longest bull run in U.S. history, that we've got record stock valuations across the board. And again, there are reasons for that. Record low interest rates. Look, the valuations are what they are. Okay. And 8 or 9 out of 10 are as high as they've ever been, if not higher. In a market like that, you've got to look at the risk side of things more. So the great thing about these models is that when they read recessionary indicators, they automatically start scaling back your exposure to stocks and increasing your exposure to things like U.S. government bonds that typically go up during recessions and, nasty times in the economy and in the markets. The safe stuff goes up when bad things happen, right? Makes sense. And these models have been incredible about it. The model we used, it lowered our clients' stock exposure to 35% on November 1st and then went back to, 70 or 80% stock exposure on February 1st. So you didn't have that big nasty dip. You missed out on some of the bounce back, right, from the day after Christmas until February 1st. But you didn't need to participate in all that bounce back because you'd come through much better there at the end of the year when the market dropped 20%. So it has a way of rounding out volatility. And most importantly, you know, again, there's no guarantees, but most importantly, eliminating the possibility of that big catastrophic loss, a 40 or 50% drawdown. Anyway, we're not the only people that utilize that. There's a very similar portfolio that's based on many of the same things issued by Charles Schwab. Good portfolio, very similar to ours in terms of performance and cost. I think ours is a little bit cheaper. But that's because of things that we do at Bulwark to kind of offset those costs. Mainly one of the things that we do is we've got institutional trading agreements with TD Ameritrade. So when the computer model changes the allocations in the portfolio, you don't get charged any transaction fees. Anyway, long story short, we sat down there and talked to this gentleman, and that was the entirety of his portfolio. It was just that model. Good model, right? I'm not complaining about that. But he was also paying 1.5% a year, which is outrageous on a portfolio that size. And so we looked at the performance of our model and we looked at the cost of our model, because for his portfolio, we'd have been charging him less than half of that amount per year. And we looked at the performance of our model and the cost savings. And just by switching, little bit better performance in ours, but also saving about 1% a year. By switching to our models, he got very close performance, a little bit better performance from our model, and saved that 1% a year. We extrapolate that out over a 10-year period of time, and it was about a 20% difference. Again, same idea, same base, just 20% difference over 10 years by lower fees. And that gets us into our discussion about the new diversification. I love that algorithmically managed model, but here's the deal. A lot of those algorithmically managed models were built over what's happened over the last 10 years. There's big chances that those things don't work the way that they used to in the past. So with us, that's one portion of a portfolio. The other part of it is we've got a traditionally managed portfolio. and you know, made up of stocks and funds, that is much more of a value approach, a traditional approach. Then we've got our bond replacement strategy. We look at the performance of those portfolios over the last 10 years, and we're doing it at about a third less the cost, on average somewhere between 1.5% to 2.5%, depending on, don't quote me, but this kind of difference. We're not blowing it out of the water, but 1.5%, 2.5% makes a big deal over the course of a 10-year period of time. And a good chunk of that is just fee reduction, right? Like I said. But way less volatility as well. And this is what I was explaining to the client. I said, first of all, you're getting charged way too much. That's ridiculous. If you've got a $2 million portfolio and you're getting charged 1.5%, you are getting taken to the cleaners. I mean, that's $35,000. No, what is that? That's $30,000. No, yeah, $30,000 a year. And a computer is the one managing it. Anyway. But that new diversification, the other thing is you just need more, you need more things in there. What if we go through a scenario and look, in today's world, as crazy as things are, what is the probability of us going through events that were not able to be foreseen or predicted when those models were created? One of those types of events seems to happen once a week now. Okay, so you need other types of diversification. And our definition of new diversification is A, introducing an algorithmic aspect to the portfolio. I know that some of you are going to react like I initially did, which is, it's like Skynet and Terminator 2. We can't let the machines run the portfolios. They're going to blow them up. Look, if that's what you think, give us a call. I can walk you through how that's not the case. Again, especially if it's part of a diversified approach. So then the other diversified approach is we've got our bond replacement strategy, right? That's guaranteed against loss, that has no management fees, that's capturing 50 to 60% of the upside of the stock market with a guarantee against loss. Okay, that's our bond replacement strategy. And then our more traditional, actively managed, right, value type stock portion of the portfolio as well. And that's kind of that process that we refer to as new diversification. And why do we think that's important? A, let's start with the value side of the portfolio. Regardless of trends, regardless of time, value has consistently, over long periods of time, been the best performing type of asset there is, period, in the stock market. It's outperformed over a long enough period of time every other sector out there, every other type of class of stock. It's outperformed growth. It's outperformed emerging markets. It's outperformed everything else, right? U.S. value, plain and simple. Okay, that hasn't been popular over the last 6 years, but what do we know about markets? That's probably the period of time when it's the most important to have it in there, right? Everybody wants to chase what they should have bought. Nobody wants to buy the thing that's performed the least, you know, the worst over the past 6 years. But we know through time and through data and research that that's exactly what you should do in general, right? There are some exceptions, as there always is. But then the other part of that, like I said, is the algorithmic side of the portfolio that's a little more momentum gained. And the reason we need that is because of the blow up in algorithmically managed portfolios. Algorithmic trading or machine-based trading makes up 90% of the trading volume that takes place on the New York Stock Exchange every day. Whether we like it or not, the rules of the road have changed, and there's got to be a part of the portfolio or your portfolio in our estimation that reflects that. There's got to be a part of the portfolio that is going along with that, that's participating rather than swimming against that current. We talk about swimming against currents all the time. That's the same logic we use for our bond replacement strategy that's worked so great for clients. Okay, so we've got those two aspects. Then we've got the aspect of our bond replacement strategy, right? And what we have is a portfolio that is capturing way more of the upside of the market, doing it at a fraction of the price. And guys, if you want to see why that's important, if you're out there paying 1.5% on $2 million, call us. It's crazy. First of all, you probably have an incomplete portfolio like this gentleman we sat with yesterday. It's just one style, just that algorithmic approach. Not a good idea, right? Not a good idea. That portfolio is not going to perform well when this switches from being a momentum-based market to a value-based market, which we think may be in the process of happening right now. The other side of it is, by utilizing the bond replacement strategy, we're getting a good portion of that equity upside, and we're significantly outperforming the vast majority of bond funds, and we're doing it with a guarantee against loss, right? A guarantee against loss and no management fees. So that's that process of new diversification. And, you know, look, like I've told you before, I don't expect anybody to take our word for it. But we have a better way to do things. We have a better way to increase your upside potential while lowering your volatility, meaning that overall you're going to have a safer portfolio. And we can drastically reduce your fees. And guys, if fees are the only guaranteed portion of a portfolio, are they the only thing? No, I think people have a tendency. Now, again, I'm not saying this because I'm biased. I'm really not. I think people have a tendency to overcook the fee side of things because there is an aspect of it in finance that is true, just like it is everywhere else, that you get what you pay for. And some better products and some better investments are going to cost more. Despite what everybody else out there wants you to believe, there are hedge funds out there that are worth their management fee. Okay, but not everything. Certainly not when we're in a generic, algorithmically managed portfolio, meaning that it's not a portfolio that you've got a portfolio manager sitting there managing for you every single day. And there's just a better way to do things. If you want access to that better way to do things, if you want to know what that looks like, if you want to know how much we can save you in fees and how much more upside we can give you, which, guys, these are things you should all want to know, especially considering what you're going to hear from Peter Bukvar in the interview. We know it's a time to manage risk. We know it is. But let's also think about getting more upside, right? We all want that. And way too few investors aren't taking advantage of that opportunity. What is that opportunity? In a record low interest rate environment, we can deploy our bond replacement strategy and get way more upside because we're getting 50 to 60% of that upside in the stock market, and we're doing it at no risk and no cost. Not to mention the introduction of an algorithmically managed part of your portfolio and then still having that part that's traditional and value-based. It's the new diversification. And if that sounds interesting to you, give us a call, 866-779-RISK. Again, 866-779-RISK. You can go to the radio show website, knowyourriskradio.com. Go to bulwarkcapitalmanagement.com. And look, if you don't want to call us, if you just want to dip your toe into the water, I can assure you, you're not going to get attacked. You're not going to be on a calling list. We're not going to bug you over and over. You can actually just email us, and we can do that correspondence over email. But we build portfolios this way. We have interviews like we do today because we are building portfolios for our clients that work no matter what happens. Right? No matter what happens. And here's the other thing. If you're unsure about the efficacy of your portfolio, go back to when you started. Go back to the projections that you were given about how much that portfolio was going to make. And then go back and look at the last 20 years and tell me if you made that much. Here's what I'm willing to guarantee you. You didn't. How do I know that? Because stocks themselves have performed almost 3.5% below their long-term average over the last 20 years. Now, most of that is due to the crack up in 08 and 2000, the tech bubble. The other side of it, though, what's the other part of your portfolio? It's the bonds, right? Record low interest rates. On average, a traditional stock bond portfolio is somewhere between underperformance of somewhere between 40 to 50% of the projections. You've got the proof that what you do doesn't work. You're also paying too much for it. So give us a call. Again, 866-779-RISK, 866-779-RISK. You can also follow us at KYR Radio on Twitter. Get our daily economic thoughts. You can download the white paper from Roger Ibbotson, Dr. Roger Ibbotson, concerning our bond replacement strategy at bulwarkcapitalmanagement.com. And plenty of resources. You can even see some videos of us and the family. I don't know if that'll interest you. But anyway, I'd encourage you guys, give us a call, reach out, email, and just get a second opinion. Just see how much you can save in fees and how much more upside you can get. It's just a better way to do it. Better mousetrap. Anyway, we got to run. I hope you guys have a wonderful weekend. We've got the interview with Peter Bukvar coming up next. And then it's going to cut off. We don't have enough time to air the whole thing. So if you want to hear the remainder of the interview, you can go to our website, sign up for our podcast on iTunes. But I think the easiest way to do it is to Google Know Your Risk Radio Stitcher. Stitcher's a big podcast website. You Google Know Your Risk Radio Stitcher. The first thing that pops up is that that deal. You click on there, you can get this most recent interview with Peter Bukvar, and then all the other interviews we've done too. You can also subscribe so they'll get emailed to you directly, because you don't want to miss it. I mean, Darren, I mean, I know you listen to every episode. The folks don't want to miss the most scintillating hour of finance radio. Yeah, it's, I know. He's nodding. He's nodding approving. You can't see it here, but even the millennial agrees. He's even addicted to this stuff. I don't think he is. I think he's lying to me. Anyway, we got to run. You guys have a great weekend. Thank you so much for joining us. Hope you enjoy the interview. And until next week, this is Know Your Risk Radio on AM 770 KTTH.
What does outside-the-box investing really look like? Schedule your free risk review with Zach Abraham, Chief Investment Officer at Bulwark Capital Management, and see a side-by-side comparison of your current portfolio versus one Zach would recommend. Schedule your free risk review at knowyourriskradio.com.
One of the biggest mistakes you can make heading into retirement is not planning for the high costs of an extended healthcare situation. A lot of people assume they have enough money saved only to watch everything they've worked hard for get whittled down to nothing from the ongoing costs of a long-term care situation. Don't make this mistake. By putting a long-term care plan in place, you guarantee yourself a source of funds to pay for care when needed, and you also know you won't become a burden on your family. Do what my wife and I did. Go learn all about the new long-term care plans offered by 525 Advisors. These new plans protect your savings, protect your family, and pay your estate back if you never use them. Learn more by attending one of the upcoming classes taught by Brian Ott, who's the host of Long-Term Care Radio right here on Cairo. Their classes coming up in July, Saturday the 20th and Monday the 22nd. Seating's limited, so sign up today at 525longtermcare.com. Classes are free. You'll get a copy of Brian's book, too. Go to 525longtermcare.com.
We've all heard the term buy low and sell high, and markets have recently hit another all-time high. And that begs the question, is this the top? Hey, it's Zach Abraham, Chief Investment Officer of Bulwark Capital and host of Know Your Risk Radio. Is this the top? No one knows. The truth is, we no longer need to know. By using our risk-managed stock portfolios and Bulwark's bond replacement strategy, we can lower your fees, increase your upside, and drastically reduce your risk exposure. This is now the longest bull market in U.S. financial history, and stock valuations have never been higher. Don't risk it. Call us now and get your free copy of our brand new booklet, Common Sense Investing, and learn how to protect your retirement against loss but still participate in market gains. Call 866-779-RISK. Again, 866-779-RISK, or go to knowyourriskradio.com.
Bulwark Capital Management is a DBA of Clear Creek Financial Management, a registered investment advisor.
You're listening to Know Your Risk Radio with Zach Abraham, Chief Investment Officer at Bulwark Capital Management.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, and welcome back to the show. And we have the privilege today of being joined by somebody that I've been wanting to get on here for a while, somebody that I've been watching for a while, a CNBC contributor, a rare voice of reason on Bubble Vision, and a guy that I just think makes a lot of sense. And really excited to be joined by Peter Bukvar, CIO of Bleakley Advisory. Peter, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me on, Zach.
Yeah, it's great. So reading up on you, we graduated from George Washington University, and then you went to work for Omega Advisors. Did you go to work for Omega right out of college?
No, Omega wasn't until many years later. I actually went to law school for 1 year.
Oh, gotcha.
After college, and realized that I didn't go to law school to be a lawyer, but I got a summer job working for an investment bank, and was there for a couple of years, and then was at a military back for 18 years, and it was after that stint that I went to Omega.
Gotcha.
And was there for only a brief period.
Gotcha. So just a brief stop on the way.
Yes.
Okay, and now you are the Chief Investment Officer. You were with the Lindsay Group for a while, if I'm not mistaken, and now you're at the Bleakley Advisory Group, and you're still a contributor on CNBC, correct?
Yes.
Gotcha.
Yes.
So kind of give me an idea. Give our listeners a little, just a little 30,000 foot view, just a little summary of what you guys are doing at Bleakley and your approach as to, what you're looking out for, how you're managing client assets, and what you, obviously you're the chief investment officer, what your role is, and how you participate in the building of client portfolios. And I'm assuming you're more on the strategic side, watching macroeconomic involvements and developments and things of that nature.
Well, sort of all of the above. I manage two portfolios, and one is a global macro strategy, individual stocks, credit, commodities, currencies, and then the other one is an income portfolio in preferred equities and fixed income. It's more probably in a world of low returns. That could be, I think, helpful to people. In addition to that, I oversee the investment process and the 30 different advisors there that help to create their own portfolios for clients, which also includes my strategies, but other strategies as well. So that, in addition to marketing the firm and basically trying to keep people out of trouble from an investment standpoint.
Yeah, which is...
So I'm doing a combination of the things that you mentioned.
Gotcha.
In addition to managing money myself.
Yeah, so you're not very busy then.
A lot
of time to play golf, right?
Yeah, of course.
Okay, so and now I've been following you for a while. Always appreciated your stuff on CNBC. Like I said, it was a breath of fresh air when you'd come on because you weren't cheerleading markets. Give us a little bit of a take. You don't have to go deep into it, but you and I have never actually spoken person, and I feel like I've got a good handle on your views and take on things, but kind of give us a rundown of where we've been and where we currently are and the things that you guys are concerned about. We don't have to deep dive into it, but just kind of give me that overview of where you're at, what you're watching, and where we're at, where we're going from here.
Well, any student of history and a student of the markets, even though each cycle is certainly different than the prior one, there's still certain things that you have to pay attention to. And when you get to certain points, you have to know when to be aggressive and when to be defensive and watch your back. So when I look at the landscape, I say, okay, we're in the 10th year of this economic cycle, and basically a few weeks from one that has never lasted this long. And what are the odds that it far surpasses the previous record? Then I have the Fed that is about to embark on a rate cutting cycle. Well, what's happened the last few times that they've cut rates? Well, it's always in response to a slowdown that accelerates into a recession. Then, I'm one of the, seems like few people left that pay attention to valuations. And valuations in the equity market, not even talking about valuations in global bonds, which are obviously historic, particularly those that are yielding less than zero. In equity market, that's expensive. Now, expensive stays expensive and until it doesn't. But you never make a short-term decision on the valuation. It's more of a longer-term thing. So I have an economic cycle that's long in the tooth. I have the Fed that wants to cut rates in response to slowing growth. I have an equity market that's very expensive on valuations other than a PE multiple. If you look at price to cash flow, if you look at price to sales, to use those two as an example, at least in price to sales metric, you're looking at a multiple that's not too far from where we were in 2000. So with that sort of backdrop, you have to say, okay, when is this going to matter for markets? And that's always the most difficult thing, but For a market generally, looking at the S&P, pretty much has gone nowhere since January 2018. And we know that the Russell has lagged, the Transportation Index has lagged. And then you throw on, of course, this whole trade situation that I believe is the main catalyst for the economic slowdown. And it's one of those environments where you got to be watching your back really closely. It's a time where you take all time out on making aggressive investments. It's a time when you say, okay, should I be building up more cash? Should I be taking less risk? And I think it just happens to be one of those times. And in light of all the things that I just mentioned.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I agree wholeheartedly, and we're one of those right along with you where we're, you know, not myopically, but very, very focused on the valuation side of things. And, you know, one of the things that I think, and I've spoken to Toby Carlisle about this on our show. I don't know if you know Tobias, but anyway, he's big value guy, and he and I have spent a lot of time discussing this. One of the toughest parts about this cycle, and I'd love to hear your thoughts on this as well, is that not only is it insane, not only are the valuations insane, but much like, I guess 98 to 99, value stocks, stuff that you and I are looking at, stuff that we're trying to pay attention to, they're coming off their worst stretch of 6-year performance in relative to growth ever, longest. I mean, I think you had a bigger performance spread there at the beginning of, or at the end of 99 and 2000. But not only are the valuations nuts, but the value stocks haven't performed. We just sent out a newsletter this week to our clients speaking about that directly. It looks like things may be turning. Do you think that this is how do we explain that in the longest bull market in U.S. history? Valuations reaching record levels, and I'm with you. I mean, 8 out of 10 different valuation metrics we're looking at are over the 95th or 94th percentile, something like that. In an environment like this, what do you attribute that to? Is that just people turning risk off, thinking the Fed's got their back and buying risk assets, and just ignoring traditional value type stocks? You know, like I said, what do you attribute that to? Not only the nuts valuations, but also the underperformance of value stocks.
It was very mediocre. We didn't have until 2018. We didn't have 1 year that saw GDP growth above 3%. So in that type of environment, if you're an investor looking for outsized returns in the context of slow growth and very low interest rates, you just flock to those faster growing companies. And like I said earlier, valuations don't matter until they do. You just focus on the growth side and you don't focus on the valuation side. So you've had a long run of low rates, sluggish growth, and I think that helps explain the growth outperformance relative to value. Now, you have the potential with a legacy of a couple of years of Fed tightening and the balance sheet shrinking, notwithstanding them about to reverse some of that, and all of a sudden valuations begin to matter. And maybe paying a $1 trillion market cap for Amazon is maybe a little bit too much right now, and maybe we have to start paying attention to valuations. And if growth is now slowing, well, maybe that 25% growth rate is all of a sudden going to be 20%, or it's going to be 15%. Well, if that's the case, why am I going to pay the same multiple? So valuations now all of a sudden matter. So I think that gap between growth and value is not necessarily closing, but I think the differential has peaked out in this cycle.
Yeah, well, from your lips to God's ears, I it sure looks like that to us, and I'm holding on, hoping that is the case. The thing that I understand investors, Josh Wolf put out a thread in the last week or so that I thought was really prescient when he was talking about, you know, why, kind of, right along the lines with what you just said, the reason people are flocking to growth is because it's the one thing that's the most scarce, right? And when you start looking at the valuations of some of these companies on a mathematical basis, you know, like we've said on our show before, look, it's not if those stocks are going to take massive haircuts, but it's when. On a mathematical basis, you can't make any sense of it. And we could, you know, we could talk Beyond Meat. That's the latest and greatest. But, you know, Shopify. I mean, there's so many where you're just looking at that, scratching your head going, I can't come up with a fundamental reason why these stocks are where they're at. And I think one of the things that people should be nervous about is, well, again, much like 99-2000, right? It's not just that people are overexposed. A lot of these retail portfolios I'm looking at, obviously not when they become clients of ours, but they're laden down in this stuff. And they're overexposed even if it was just normal times. You know, we're seeing tech making up 40, 50, 60% of clients' allocations in their portfolios. It's just kind of like everybody has just thrown caution to the wind and they're just chasing growth. And I, you know, I get the scarcity of it, like you said, the slow growth environment kind of stemming from that. But do you think the internet, what do you think? I mean, you said that that multiple has peaked out, or that outperformance has peaked out, or, you know, they've reached their pinnacle here in this cycle. And I tend to agree with you. Is that what you do you attribute that to, just the slowdown that we're seeing economically? And do you think that this slowdown is the slowdown? I mean, do you think this is the beginning of a recession, or do you think this is just kind of a cyclical a soft patch?
Well, to that last point, if you look at manufacturing, not just in the U.S., but around the world, you go by the PMI, we're in a contraction. It's only slightly below the flat line, but it's still below. So this could be the beginning of a further contraction. And you know, it's no question that global trade has been slowing well before the tariffs. And then you just throw on the tariffs and all the uncertainty and the damage it does to confidence on top of that. And so that area, the global economy is already in a recession, I can argue.
Yep.
And what we're now beginning to see is it's spillover into services. You look at markets number in the U.S. Last week, and services number is now trending closer to 50. We'll see what ISM has to say in the coming week or two. So we are headed in that direction. Now, whether it goes into an official recession or how long it lasts or how deep it gets, well, that's to follow. Right now, you just have to focus on the trajectory, and the trajectory is clearly pointing to slower growth. I mean, the world, I don't pay attention to economic estimates of the World Bank or the IMF, but David Malpass, who's now the head of the World Bank and the chief economist previously, who I have respect for, and I take his estimates not with a grain of salt, but I pay more attention. He estimates global growth at 2.6%. That's global growth at 2.6%. If you throw in, let's just call it a 1.5% inflation rate, even 2, you're talking about nominal GDP growth at maybe 4.5%. We haven't seen that sort of growth rate in years. So when you're paying not a multiple of earnings, but all of a sudden now people rationalize certain valuations by a premium to or price to revenue of 20 times for some of these new IPOs and other valuations, this slowdown starts to matter because no one is immune to an economic slowdown. And just take the FANG stocks. Take it Facebook and Google, for example, without necessarily giving anything specific on their stocks, but you know, at the end of the day, they're shell advertising companies. Well, what's more cyclical than, okay, advertising? Growth slows, you're going to trim in your advertising budget. If you're Amazon, okay, Amazon is a great company, but a lot of their AWS clients are small companies. Well, that outsource their needs, their cloud needs to Amazon. Well, if they rein it in, if they go out of business, well, Amazon's going to get affected. And their retail business, of course, is cyclical. So everyone is going to be affected by this economic slowdown. It's just a matter from here is what degree. And from the market perspective, the market's filled with the belief that, oh, yeah, the Fed's going to somehow create a soft landing and a couple of rate cuts will do it. And then, you know, there'll be this great trade deal with China and the slowdown in manufacturing is only temporary and everything's going to be kumbaya and everything's going to be fine. And I think that's where the loggerheads are taking place right now within the markets. And of course, with the market just near record highs, they're focused more on the latter than the former.
Well, and how much of that do you, I mean, again, I agree with 100% of what you said. How much do you attribute that to the Fed? Because I look at the Fed's role in all this, and I feel like, and again, I don't think that you're going to be far off from this statement, but I feel like they've anesthetized the market to the point where, you know, it's like a bunch of, you know, old folks running around that have been way over, you know, doped by their doctors and you know, anti-anxiety drugs. And it's like everybody's kind of walking around comatose, just believing that, you know, and I've seen it. I'd be curious if you guys have seen it on the retail side. I've seen these average retail investors are so they've got this bulletproof feeling about them, because every time there's been a bump in the road, the Fed's been there to jump in and flood the market with liquidity. How much do you attribute this current setup and this underperformance of value and these crazy valuations? How much do you lay at the of that do you lay at the feet of the Fed?
No question, a lot of it, because you're willing to take more risks if you feel that somebody has your back. But do they really have your back? That's the question. I think the perception certainly has been over the last 10 years is yes, they do, because they responded to every economic downturn with easing, whether it was actual rate cuts, whether it was QE, or whether it was some sort of a verbal rate cut, which we've certainly seen this year. The question now is, what does that mean now moving from here? Because if the Fed is on the cusp of cutting rates, at least right now, the market's more focused on, yes, the Fed is cutting, rather than analyzing the reason why they are cutting.
Yeah.
But if this economic downturn does intensify, if it starts to hit earnings, which I expect it to, and I expect to see earnings estimates continue to fall this year, well, then you'll see a change in the perception of the ability of central banks and the Fed to help things. When you look at the experience of the ECB and the BOJ, the one clear thing that they've done is they've completely destroyed profitability of its banking system. So here we've had 30 years of Bank of Japan easing, and the Japanese Bank Topics Index, or Topics Bank Index, in nominal terms, is down 90% from where it was 30 years ago. That's 9-0. The European Bank Stock Index is down 40% from where it was in 2014 when the ECB started negative interest rates, which proves that, at least if you're a bank, the central bank is not only not going to save you, they're going to hurt you. So if banks are the transmission mechanism for monetary policy and you're damaging the banks, then you know you've basically run out of bullets in terms of monetary policy. So at least in that sector, the central bank is not going to help you. And fast forward to the next economic downturn, which we could be on the cusp of, we are going to see sort of monetary impotence in the sense of rate cuts aren't going to help economic growth. Because people have to understand what the whole point of monetary policy is that when a central bank cuts interest rates, what they're doing is they're not creating new economic growth that wouldn't have happened otherwise. All they're doing is pulling it forward. They're telling you, you know what, I know you're saving for a house, but how about this? If I lower interest rates down to a certain level today, will you save less and go out and extend yourself and buy that house today instead of waiting till tomorrow or still waiting 6 months or 12 months or 2 years down the road? We're going to incentivize you to do it today. And that $45,000 car that you want to buy, even though you make 60 grand a year, well, I'm going to lower rates now to incentivize you to take that loan from 4 years to 8 years and you can buy it today. So it has that immediate and impact that lasts for a couple of years. The problem is that once you get into perpetual easing, it no longer incentivizes behavior today that would have happened tomorrow, because I just know, well, rates are staying low forever. There's no incentive for me to do anything because there's no urgency to act. And there you get into a situation like Japan that's now being experienced by Europe, that this forever easing is not creating any new behavior that wasn't going to happen otherwise. And that's the risk that we now run here, is that the Fed will try to cut rates, but there's no new behavior it's going to incentivize. Rates are already low. They've already been low for a long time. And in fact, the bond market's already eased for the Fed. If you're looking to buy a home, the bond market's just cut rates by 100 basis points for you. Who cares what the Fed's going to do from here? So when the Fed starts shooting blanks out of their gun, people wake up to that fact, like, oh my, this is really not going to slow this economic slowdown, or mitigate it, I should say, and it's not going to stop earnings estimates from falling. Well, then, do I really want to pay 18 times earnings for stocks? Maybe I want to pay 16 times. Maybe I want to pay 14 times for a slowing growth rate.
As we warned you at the start of the show, due to time constraints, we've got to cut this interview off. But you can catch the remainder of the interview on our website. You go to bulwarkcapitalmanagement.com and go to our iTunes page. But I think the easiest way to do it is just Google Know Your Risk Radio Stitcher. Stitcher's a podcast website. We're right on there. Got a great list of all of our episodes, and you can even subscribe. So anyway, have a wonderful day. Hope you enjoy the remainder of the interview, and we'll see you next week. This is Know Your Risk Radio on AM 770 KTTH.
Thanks for listening to Know Your Risk Radio. Whether it's preservation of capital or an aggressive growth strategy, every investor needs a clearly defined risk profile. Schedule your free risk review at knowyourriskradio.com. Tune in next week to Know Your Risk Radio with your host, Zach Abraham, Chief Investment Officer at Bulwark Capital Management.